So earlier this morning we chanted our Boundless Way lineage dedication, and the last name we mentioned was Great Master George Bowman Bowman. And here's the cool thing, he's sitting right here. So he's come up from the wilds of Kentucky to sit with us for a few days, and David and I are very happy to have him here. As most of you know, he's David's personal teacher, and he's also our very dear friend.
Thank you. Well, I'm always when I chant my name in this lineage, I always wonder who could that possibly be. Melissa reminded me that it's me. So you know that joke about the Pope who has a dream, and he feels in the dream beset by difficulties and challenges. As it says, and he is inconvenienced in his dream, like this. It really caught me. This Lord three times stopped in the middle of his bath, and three times left the dinner table. He dreamt, I suppose. Well, if it's like my dream, he was in quite an intimate place, enjoying his bath or his dinner. What he imagined was a private sanctuary, and in his dream he was interrupted, and he. Was beset by challenges and didn't know what in the world to do or how to manage these visitors that were coming to him in his dream. And he thought, what would I do? And he thought in his dream, I know what I'll do. I'll ask the Pope. And then he woke up, and it was a mixed blessing that he was the Pope. And there wasn't someone else to ask. So, reading this beneficial action piece by Dogen, when I read it, I oftentimes, for me, I don't know if it must be the same for you. I read it, and there are certain phrases that will pop up and flirt with me, or touch me, or seem to be alive or of value. And it's interesting studying texts, studying Dogen or studying the sutras, or even just doing the liturgy, or even studying the text of ourself, the presentation of our habitual selves. There are different aspects of self that are lively and flirt with us, or feel like somehow they touch us in some place that has value or meaning or aliveness. And this piece about the this Lord in the text, or this practitioner of the Dharma who was interrupted and inconvenienced by things. When I first read it, I thought, oh, that's irrelevant. And yet, when I read it this time, it touched me in a certain way. I often feel, as I'm sure you do, you know, where was I before I was interrupted or inconvenienced by this present moment? And the moment comes and finds me, or the aliveness of the moment comes and finds me on my cushion. And sometimes the aliveness of the moment is a visitor or something that shows up in the intimacy of Zazen, or in this place of both great safety and great vulnerability simultaneously. I think that would describe Zazen practice for us. And in this place of great safety, or the great possibility for safety, not always feels so safe, and the possibility for some openness or tenderness or vulnerability to encounter the guest, or the aliveness, or the koan, if you will, of the moment, both sometimes are, that they're both here, aren't they? I appreciate this, the Zendo, as a place of great safety. I am surrounded by good friends, compatriots along the way, colleagues. Some of you I've known for 30, some of us go back almost 40 years now. We're sitting in the room, and some 30 years, and some are new new faces, but in some way, the new faces who come that I don't know or I don't know so well or I'm just getting to know are ancient friends. So I sit in this place of a place of great safety, a place where this space that we hold as a zendo or dojo or place of practice, the place of practice, we hold it in our hearts, and we also, by holding it in our hearts, we create a space of safety, a place of sila, a place of discipline, but not with the intention of rigidity or copying something, but with the intention that if we are steady, and if we are bright, and if we allow the mind to settle more deeply into itself, if we can become a little bit more serene and tranquil and present, and simultaneously open our hearts, our mind-heart, not heart as opposed to mind, but our, we say, shin-kokoro, the heart of our bodhisattva practice, then there is this sense that guests come and go, and we welcome them, and they come, you come, and the guests of my mind come and go in a place that is safe or free from intrigue and free from politic and free from aggression and denial and greed. Not that greed and denial and aggression don't continually arise. They certainly do in my mind, as I know they do in yours. But we, as bodhisattvas, have an intention to not identify with this ongoing parade of thought and feeling. We have the intention not to identify with the thought-feeling mass, as it is sometimes called, the thought-feeling mass of our construction of and our insistence on a reality, that it shape or be a certain way. And we hold this space and dare to. And it's quite a daring thing, I think, to be open in this way and to allow the many beings to come and go, and to resist through both the openness and the will of our intention. It's always a combination of both, isn't it? It's a combination to be able to welcome visitors or to be interrupted, or to have visitors come and go. It requires two simultaneous practices. One of those practices is, in the Buddhist tradition, we say shamatha practice, the practice of calm abiding, abiding with the breath, calm abiding with the breath, or calm abiding with your posture, trusting in your posture, trusting everything to your posture. If you're practicing shikantaza, the upright posture, or if you're working on koan, many, many different ways, of course, to work with koan, but to settle or abide with mu, or however you're working. That capacity for shamatha or calm abiding, of course, is absolutely essential, or we are, or we just wish and wash our vow away. We wish and it's washed away. We are flibbertigibbets. We say, wouldn't it be grand if we just paid attention for a few shining moments and we're gone? You know, just inducted into this thought-feeling mass, these endless rounds of thinking. And oftentimes, of course, there's nothing wrong with thinking. It's just what goes on. But oftentimes we are inducted into, what did Krishnamurti call it? He called it a stream of vulgarity. We are inducted into a stream of self-clinging. So our shamatha practice, or this calm abiding practice, which is intentional and to some degree willful, in the sense that we want to be here, we want to be present, we want to show up, we want to be, so that a practice of getting lost, getting on board the trains that come to the station and riding off, blacking out happens again and again, of course. And that happening, that human happening of getting lost in the cortex of the mind is not our fault. It's not a matter of fault. It's not a matter of blame. It's not a matter of being a bad Zen practitioner or student. It's just the fact of human life. It is our collective karma as human beings that we have this tendency to trade our wonderfully bright, clear, responsive, intelligent, loving Buddha nature for a another vehicle, we might say, not such a smooth running vehicle, more an old Edsel that stalls and doesn't start and all of that. So this shamatha practice or this calm abiding, I think is very, very important personally. In the Buddhist tradition, there are endless discussions, debates, heated arguments, exchanges about which is more important, opening the hand of thought and just being present to the suchness of things in the moment as they are, and being open and being human and being present and cultivating that, or this practice which requires discipline and focus. And the Buddha was very, very clear in his insistence and his teaching that they are not separate things. They are two ways of appreciating one thing, two qualities of attention. He called them the balanced qualities. He said these two qualities are essential in two aspects of one thing: openness and willingness to open the hand of thought, to open the gate, to melt or soften the defense or the denial or the grasping, the softening and opening too, but then having the stability to be able to be with what it is that shows up as we're in the bath or as we're interrupted from our dinner table. And so this is our koan study, our self-study. The teaching is about this self-study and this capacity that we have as baby bodhisattvas or practitioners of the way, is that this original mind of ours, this innate wakefulness, has the capacity to know and appreciate its particular expression in all forms. That was the Buddha's proclamation that we revere as practitioners of Buddha Dharma. How fantastic, how marvelous, how wonderful. One by one, each thing has it. One by one, each thing is perfectly complete. And of course, sometimes we realize that and are touched or are awed, or our heart melts. We are touched by the sound of the bird, or we are touched by the creak of the floor, and we realize in those moments of the ta of shikantaza, the touching and being touched by something immediate and alive, that is our own wonderful self-nature. We encounter it in that way, and we are deeply inspired. And we can't help but shed tears of gratitude. Our raksus are at times dark, stained dark with our tears of appreciation that we have found a way of living and of being with ourself and with the moment that is true, not false, that is such a blessing, such a completely undeserved blessing when it happens, when the mind opens. It is not by contrivance or by pruning or grafting or by shoring ourselves up here or taking a little bit away there, but it is by cutting the gap, as we say, and just being so. And we are inspired. Each one of us is inspired. In different ways, we have different Dharma doors that we enter. And then we are inspired and touched, and then we are determined to go forward in a practice to be able to welcome more people into the dining room table, or being able to welcome more visitors in our house in trust, even though that trust is often something that requires, oftentimes there really isn't a trust because we are overwhelmed by it all. But somewhere in our minds we know that if we head little by little in this way, that we can encounter more and more, more and more. And that in the Zen tradition, this capacity to, on the one hand, practice almost, in some ways it's a contrived thing, isn't it? To be steady, to be to practice shamatha, to try and be open. And then by practicing over and over and over and over something again and again, by the repetition and renewal, by doing it again and again, we find our way into some moments when it does this and we are done by it and we say, oh, how wonderful, how fabulous. So our koan study then is having each one of us having had that experience, that opening and that knowing and touching and being touched by, to intend to welcome more visitors. And, that's koan study. Koan means a truth happening place. To engage or to be with or to participate in the place of truth, the aliveness, the immediacy of the moment, and to be willing to do more and more of that. And that process of koan study, whether it's through the formal koan study or through the koan study of the self-fulfilling samadhi, this jijuyu zanmai of self-encountering itself in a naked and immediate way. The same thing, shikan taza. Shikan is koan, pausing, slowing down, being with. And ta is the case of the koan, whatever that may be that's alive. Or these collections of koans that we study are encounters, self-fulfilling encounters. And when the self recognizes itself in this form, then something happens. So we celebrate that, and we are determined as practitioners to go forward in this way and to create a zendo, zendo in our own bellies, and also this zendo. And the world, of course, needs this presence and this possibility of presence so profoundly. So my deep appreciation for being here with you guys, old friends, for your work in creating this place of practice. What a wonderful thing, and what a wonderful offering to the community at large, a place, a dojo, a place where the visitors come and present themselves and step aside and then make room for another. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. So, thank you, George. We are going to have our Dharma dialogue now. And what this is an opportunity to speak, ask questions, comment on your own practice, make observations in dialogue all together. So we'll start by saying our names. I'm Melissa.
Steve.
I'm Fran.
Matt.
Bob.
Laura.
James.
Steve.
Jamie.
Lynn.
Diane.
Peter.
David.
George.
And please make yourselves comfortable if you haven't already done that.
George, thank you.
You're welcome.
And thank you for talking about welcoming more visitors. So today when I was reading this section, when it talks about beneficial action equally toward enemy, you know, friend and enemy,
right.
You know, and I, for the first time, you know, I was thinking, oh, the enemies, what we think of as the enemies, you know, that enter our thoughts, you know, the ones that we want to not welcome in.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And also, you're talking about, you know, opening the hand of thought and And I was thinking how sometimes maybe for me that might get a little dualistic, you know, like, oh, there, here's the enemy thought. I want to open that one, let that one go, you know. So it's kind of a little slippery, you know.
It's very slippery, I'll say.
You know, maybe you could talk a little bit about that, you know. It's open to me now, but I'm, you know, just... Being with it.
Thank you. Yeah, it is very slippery and a great challenge. For me, one of the things that's been appearing as a visitor in this, especially with all that's been going on, you know, in the, all of this terror and scariness and vulnerability, is a sense of great vulnerability and scariness and groundlessness. Who will appear at the door? That kind of feeling. I recognize that in my heart, as a sort of personal koan, that's a place where I, as I loop the stupa of myself, I meet it again and again in different forms. And there's a certain energy and presence connected with it. And the commitment to mind that or be with that in... or at least discover something that I don't know about it, so that I don't assume, as I do in a very reactive way, this is what's wrong with me, and when you go away, then I will be enlightened, or then I'll be clear, or then I will be the guy who's in this list of... Yeah. So I think on a deep level, but that as metaphor for so many places and so many energies that come into our life, of how to... And I think that's, in the safety of the Zendo, has a lot to do with renunciation. That I speak for myself, we are in a safe place to experiment suspending our judgments about ourself and others, and ourself in terms of the aliveness of who we really are. A lot of who I really am is who I really don't want to be at all. But on varying shades and degrees, so that's sort of that's a way I have of framing, looking at it, and trying to be with it. And it's so alive, and so real, and so visceral, and so completely unintellectual. And I find the more that I work it, and I don't want to work it. I want to protect and hide and stay in my warm bath, and with my familiar friends. I don't want to come and meet new people in the Zendo and have to go through this whole, oh my God. But I genuinely find that as I work it, that some peace opens. And when there isn't separation from it, and it does require intentionality and openness. This is guts to open, let's face it. This is real guts ball. This is not... then something flowers. There's so much energy there and so much aliveness and truth in my life. And then it will, at times... It doesn't stay open, but it will just flower. And I think, oh my goodness, where I least suspected, where I most determined, willfully resist, with all my, you know... strategies. So, and I remember Sansini, my teacher, he had these little soundbite sayings that he used to. Sometimes they were great, and sometimes they got a little worn. But one of them was, "Is your bad, Georgie? Your bad karma is always waiting for you." I mean, you can take that a lot of ways, but it does. It does, you know, spring up. So I am quite determined, because I know it's true. Not that it's good or bad. So then it's a source of tremendous, for me, inspiration. You know, because there's no choice. I mean, I can choose to say, well, that's not who I am, but then I'm in real serious trouble. And then I make my world so small. So I hope that in some way, right, yeah.
So could you say a little bit more about the transformation that takes place? And you say it's not permanent. So, I mean, do you come back to this same place of fear or inadequacy or whatever it is, the stupa that you're circling? I mean, do you keep coming back to that same place over and over again?
Well, don't you?
I love the transformation and the...
Yeah, me too. I like that too.
I like that part.
I do too. And it is part of it. Yeah, it's a great part. But it's not a fixed position. It's really not. I mean, if I, you know, whatever I'm cautious about really speaking the reality of my life to people because they think, look at you, 40 years later, and you're still, you know, sweating it out. But there is the fulfillment piece, and it's really real. And who doesn't walk out in the garden and see the shoots coming up and feel possibility and freshness and newness and great beauty and this is my nature. This is it. It's blossoming. It's a blossoming world. And then there is the other side of the Tathagata, Tathagata, the one who comes and the one who goes, just like this. Both manifestations, according to our tradition, of love and understanding and truth. And the lost side is Uchiyama said, enlightenment is active participation in loss. So that's the other side that we're talking about. Not that they're different sides, but I think that it requires a renunciation of us, that we, when we lose a friend and we are in that fire of loss, it requires some renunciation to find, in the midst of that, a invincible spring, as Kamu said.
Renunciation of what?
Opinion. That I will not, this is what, I don't mean, we're in the sea, I'm not preaching. That this is, my mind says, this is what's wrong with me. And if it weren't for this, I would be, oh, what a star I would be. You know, I would be the James Bond of Zen. You know, and slide in. Or I would be, I don't know, you can fill in the blanks are. And that other side, of course, is also the activity of love. It takes the activity of Dharma, of arising and passing, or the activity of impermanence, it takes it away from us. It takes our opinion, it takes our stratagems, it takes our away from us, and we don't want to let go because we're afraid without that, what would I be? I've invested my whole life fighting this shit. And yet, of course, you take the strategy away, and what is it? It's something else entirely. It's not a name, it's not what we think, and it is breathtaking. You go to a funeral, you feel such love, don't you? Because you care so deeply, and it's so impermanent, and so precious, and so fleeting, and your heart just, and it's absolutely true. And something that has disappeared has aroused that. And we say, I want everybody to live forever. I want to live forever. And yet, if it were so that's the, if we, you know, we took up a fulfillment and loss as thus come, thus gone, and all of the aspects of it, and growing in some kind of confidence, little by little, in such modest ways, I must say, in such modest ways. For me, I mean, but then more than enough when they're genuine, you know. I don't have to be a big poobah. Mm-hmm. I can just be Georgie, having at it again. Thanks. Yeah.
Well, and that this might be a blessing, that this might not be a mistake of ours or a mistake of the universe, that this very thing that we're totally convinced. I mean, and that's the thing, that how strongly it arises, that that we're just convinced. We can't even entertain the possibility that it might be different. You know, but right there. Yeah. Steve?
Yeah, I got caught in the little the chant that we did with Dogen, and that was written by Dogen, and in there he says something that intrigued me, in that he said, you know, enlightenment is not the loss of delusion, or I'm paraphrasing it here, that
the Okamura quote.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's nice, isn't it? Yeah.
In the, from the morning service?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's by a teacher.
And I hope I'm paraphrasing it,
sounds like you're right.
Accurately. And then at the end, you know, when we're doing the four bodhisattva vows, we say, you know, delusions are endless, you know, I vow to end them, okay? So, on one hand, you know, realization that what we create is this constant delusion, that losing that isn't necessarily enlightenment, and on the other hand, we're also saying we're going to end them. That's our vow. So, I guess a little confusion around that juxtaposition.
Just a little?
Yeah.
He points to me.
I don't wish to make it an intellectual exercise. Don't misunderstand me. Okay, this is, but it strikes me that it is a self-created world. You know, I mean, we're the sender itself is self-created.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Someone sawed the board. Someone put up the walls. I mean, this is all self-created.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Well, this really is the true meaning of koan. You know, that this. There's this dilemma that gets set up by all the teachings that we encounter, really. Because when we talk, we have to use words, and words divide the world. I mean, you know, so like, I appreciate it so much when, George, when you're talking about shamatha and opening the hand of thought, and the mind can make that, like, those are two different techniques or ways, and it's very clear that they're not. But they're just two different ways of talking about the same thing, or entry points into the same thing. So, you know, the first part of that vow is, what is it, delusions are endless? What do we say? What's our translation?
Yeah, I'm going to...
Inexhaustible.
Inexhaustible! What a great word! They're inexhaustible. They never get exhausted. Ever. Never. Not, don't even think that. That's, you know, but you will.
Yeah, and that's,
know,
a
because,
long time.
Yeah. Somehow, well, it would be better if they're gone away.
Because that's the mind coming in and saying, wouldn't it be great? So we make this vow. See, making a vow in Zen is not saying, I'm going to, you know, it's not like making a completing a project. Because it'll never end. It never ends. You know that, right? It never ends. So that's like sets it up. You know, it's one thing to say, oh, delusions are inexhaustible. Oh, man. Period. Well, that's not our teaching. It's like, okay, I vow to end them. What does it mean to end something that's inexhaustible? That's a koan. And every one of those lines in the four vows is a koan. And Okamura's commentary, he's commenting on Dogen's Genjo Koan.
Oh, that's a comment.
Yeah.
It's a comment. Okay.
Yeah, I'm and it's sorry. Very cool because he's a great speaker and great writer. And so he finds this way to confuse us even more. That's all the best writers do on Zen. So this is, this is impossible. This is impossible. This work is truly impossible. And we do it. What does that mean? We do not doing. We think not thinking in Shikantaza. What does that mean? I'm not asking, it's a rhetorical question. But the right, so, huh? And in that huh, some possibility arises. And we taste it, we know it, and it's really delicious. And then we conceptualize it. And, it's the endless cycle that you were referring to, Fran. The endless cycle, really? You know, forever. But don't make any, don't fixate on that either. It's, you can feel the mind just wants to go in and get, I get it. Oh yeah, I get it. People die all the time. Oh well. No. Oh.
Yeah, and from the, I love how Okamura talks so clearly about we come into this practice with the mind that cannot practice. as you're saying, so I don't want to make this intellectual, but of course we do.
Yeah.
We think, oh, okay, delusion's the problem. All I have to do is get rid of it.
Right.
Yeah, and we say, oh, I don't have enlightenment. I want something.
I don't have enlightenment.
What?
No. I know I don't have it.
Right. We're concerned. Would you bet on that, Steve? Yeah.
I'm convinced, yeah. Yeah. There are times when I
Well, right. And there we are, each one of us convinced that there is some other, that we too might become the great, you know, James Bond Zen master. If we could get this thing. And so, because that's all, as Melissa was saying, it's all things. And Okamura is suggesting that delusion is not a thing and enlightenment is not a thing. And this teaching that we already have it is the teaching that makes no sense, the koan. And yet coming up against it somehow creates some possibility.
You know, James and then Steve, the image which we've heard so many times of being in the bath and being disturbed. I feel like Zazen is like a warm bath. I just like, and then, you know, the bell rings and I have to get up. What? It's like there's always something bothering me, and that's life bothering me. And so this guy, this lovely image, he fixes his hair.
Great.
He fixes his hair, a little pomade. Yeah. I don't know what he's doing there, and he gets up, and now, you know, and then the greeter at the door, and we don't know what it's going to be in this very horrible, juicy warning that came up yesterday: do not open the door. Mm-hmm. No matter, you know, the people in Greater Boston area, this thing that went out on the warning. But we have, as Zen practitioners, I don't mean this literally in terms of the situation yesterday. We have to open the door. That's the vow we make over and over and over again. Now what? Now what? Now what? But we'd like to just, it's us in, warm bath, people I love, how great. It's not like that.
So, George, I was just appreciating the part where you were pointing to this sort of experience of safety. Mm-hmm. In the Zendo, right. And in the practice, right? And the sort of simultaneous vulnerability,
right.
That is the sort of sharpness of that,
right.
And I think particularly today, you know, coming here, that really having that sense of being able to or noticing that pull to create understanding, right, and answer questions and sort of have containers for all of the stuff that's been happening in Boston, and to not have to have a container for it, but to just be able to let it be without whys or answers or explanations, just
thank you.
But there's something about this place that helps.
It does help. Yes, it does.
Thank you.
So, George, you mentioned about how, you know, we identify with this this thought, feeling mass that appears in the silence,
right.
and you know, I have been wondering, you know, if, you know, my idea of how I work is just like totally wrong. You know, I mean, like, I identify, you know, with my body, of course, and my possessions and my family and all of those things. But the one thing that is most truly me,
right,
is this thinking this voice that sounds like me in my head, you know, and whatever I think, that's what I am, you know, and I think that I'm responsible, you know, I am the doer, I am, you know, like George Bush said, I am the decider, you know, that is what I am, I decide things, you know, and then I go do them, you know, I set an intention and I you know, I decide to walk from, you know, here to there, and if I don't decide to go walk, I don't, you know,
right.
and that's
yes.
how it is.
Yeah.
And yet, I think it was Melissa that mentioned about how, you know, the scientific studies show that actually the, you know, the body is in motion before the brain, you know, the higher functioning of the brain engages, you know, so I'm wondering, well, you know, how much of this stuff is just a story that I make up after the fact, you know, that, you know, like
it's all happened already.
Yeah, it's already, you know, it's right after it happens that I actually tell myself that I made this decision. You know, I already, and it's a response to something that arises in me. I'm uncomfortable and I need to stretch my legs and I, you know, I start to get up and I say, oh yeah, I decided to get up and stretch my legs. You know,
that's so well said.
I meant to do that.
So okay.
It's already, what I hear you saying is that there's some level of which it's already happened.
Right.
And then you tell a story
right.
about it.
Right.
And then you think that the story, then the mind co-opts the aliveness of the moment and says, well, I know what's going down and I'm in charge. And let me tell you, the blah, blah, blah,
right.
jabber, jabber, jabber. And of course, it's this is highly questionable.
Right. So, if I may, so then, you know, here I am, I'm sitting, you know, and these visitors come in and they disturb me and I feel really irritated about it. My reaction to new stuff is often one of, oh my, I just wish they would leave me alone. You know? I finally get comfortable.
Just
here.
Get in my bathtub.
Right,
have my,
right,
you know.
Right, right. So then I think, well, geez, Steve, you know, you really, you know, shouldn't be like this. And it's your responsibility to set this intention or you know, to fix yourself somehow, and I find myself sitting here in the Zendo going, you know, well, if I only, you know, if I just could, I know there was something I heard, you know, that, or I get something, you know, I hear something, and I think, oh, yeah, so I just need to get a little more of that, you know, and if I just, you know, just
right,
tweak
yeah.
it a little bit, then
yeah, yeah.
then I'll fix it,
yeah.
and so the thing I find myself wondering is whether that's really true at all, you know, that it's got nothing, you know, I'm busy telling myself this.
We're all wondering about that in a very, you know, determined, deep way.
Right.
Right,
because yeah.
it's really, I don't want to pretend that I've got some answer, and I identify with what you're saying, but they are assumptions that are profoundly untested. They are profoundly untested. That's what we see. And I wanted to say something about, there's one level of practice that is, there is being beset by thinking. And then there is the capacity that we have to settle a little bit more deeply into the more unimpeded spaciousness. And then you realize in that place of more openness, there are all kinds of deep movements and currents of aliveness that are passing through. So it reminds me of being in the Mammoth Caves in Kentucky, which are some of the hugest cave systems, and they were formed by underground rivers. And the rivers go underground, and they're great currents. Mm-hmm. And then they dry up, and then another one. And we enter into, when you get down into the deep work, we enter into these deep movements that are the movement of life itself, and they are not protected by thought. That's really important for us to begin to touch to that and to become more interested and not run to thought to protect. And what you're saying, you know, it's like something's going on, Mr. Jones, and you don't know what it is, do you? Or what, you know, Dylan's.
Yeah.
And yes, something is going on, and we don't know what it is on multiple levels.
Right.
It's nothing but not knowing going on. But we, and that's the, you know, that's, I think, real study.
Yeah, And I think that this, as you talk about that settling, it's easy for some of us to think, oh, well, the other people settle, and maybe someday, after 20 years, I'll settle. And I think it's so important to notice that all of us do this to some degree, that sometimes we're just, mind on fire. And so it may just be a little bit of ease and spaciousness. And that's the... And this, then we can begin to feel those currents. So this is not what happens to you after 30 years of Zen practice. This is what happens every time we sit down on the cushion.
Yeah, it's not linear. It's
right.
Not, you get writhe and then you're...
Right, and we all know and have some sense of these currents beyond our thinking. Every human being, every one of us here. Because I know sometimes... George, when you talk, I think, oh my God, maybe someday I could sense what you sense. And having been around you long enough, I know that it's not true. I mean, in the sense that there isn't some fundamentally different thing happens at some time in the future. It's happening right now.
Yes.
And each one of us has some sense.
Yeah.
Bob, you were...
Yeah, I just wanted, because Fran's question and these comments have really sort of brought something more aligned for me, which may be obvious, but like your question, well, do you really circle back to those icky places? It's like, and I know, of course, yeah, you probably do, but I really want it not to be the case.
Yeah.
I really want there to be a settling that I'll get to someday that I don't get to yet, but maybe 20, and that it is this constant arising of this yearning for this not to be it. Just this, that it's life will be something else. That it's this can't be it. And then every time we say, well, there's a great teacher sitting up there, and he's in the lineage dedication, and he must embody something different. And that you know, because you've been around him a long time. And you know it's not the truth for you to have been around.
Oh, yeah.
Wait a minute.
you bring in a new kid. And it's just that, this expression of please let this not be it. I just want to honor that.
Please let this not be it. Please. There must be some possibilities. Well, and there are paths where there are idealized masters, and you don't have to do this. You can go to the idealized master. We were talking early on because we'd seen this great movie, Kumare.
Oh, wasn't it fun?
Yeah, it actually was George recommended it to us. We've seen it twice now. About a guy who pretends to be a guru, and his message is, I am not who you think I am. I am not the guru. And it's actually true, he's not. He's just a filmmaker. He's a film director who grew his beard and grew
It's a documentary. I mean, the guy actually did this. It was a tremendous gutsy scam and craziness, but it is a true story.
And it's really touching and beautiful. It's highly recommended. But I was thinking that... somebody once told me that there are two fundamental questions we keep asking in Zen, and one of them is, what is it? Which I think you're pointing to, like, what is this? What is this? And the other one is, who am I? And I just want to return back to what Steve said, because, this conviction that we have, this Cartesian conviction, René Descartes, I think, therefore I am, that the thought definitely appears to be the root of myself. And that Zen really turns that around, it's great that there's this new scientific evidence that it might be true, that it's not that everything comes in later, and describes even a millisecond later. I think it's a tiny portion of a second, but we are so addicted to the self idea, and it's a little bit comforting, but not ultimately. Right, it's not ultimately comforting. So there is a practice where you just really, really doubt every thought that arises. Who is thinking that? who is hearing, who is breathing, who is walking. Because the little mind comes in and goes, me, yeah. me, me, yeah. me, me, me. And at a certain point, that becomes an unsatisfactory answer. So even though we keep coming around and around and around, I think there's more of a dropping away of a certain kind of... but like it's awful that we can't believe in our delusions as much anymore, because the delusions are really comforting. It would be comforting to think that I am fill in the blank.
Yeah.
But it, so that might be, you know, if we're looking for a place we're going, it's not exactly a circle. It's more of a spiral. It's just like, yeah, and you can get depressed about it, but it's really not depressing, I don't think. Although sometimes I feel very depressed.
And it would be comforting to think there's a guru out there.
Yeah, yeah, the idealized self, you know, some other person. Or, yeah.
Having lived with a lot of, you know, very accomplished people that we would idealize and put on a pedestal, it's not that. My experience of getting to know them and living with them for many years is that it's not true, that they're human beings just like us. They have incredible insight and charisma and skill, not to denigrate in any way their tremendous training, but they are just folks. And
on that note, let's take our just folks out to the garden.
Thank you.
Thank you, George.